A year ago, many Ukrainians thought Russia would never fully invade their country. But when the bombs started falling, the conventional wisdom was that Kyiv would fall within days. Of course, it did not. What remains is a grinding war of attrition where battles are fought over yards of territory. The U.S. Defense Secretary has spoken of difficult times ahead in a war that has reshaped the global economy and world alliances.
Our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us to talk about it. Anne Applebaum is a staff writer at The Atlantic and author of several books on global issues. Her latest is Twilight of Democracy. And Ron Elving is NPR's senior Washington editor and correspondent. Hello to you both.
Good to be with you.
President Biden today announced more aid to Ukraine, $2 billion for drones and ammunition. Not the F-16 fighter jets that Ukraine has been asking for. Today he spoke from Poland.
All across my country, in big cities and small towns, Ukrainian flags fly from American homes. Over the past year, Democrats and Republicans in our United States Congress have come together to stand for freedom. That's who Americans are, and that's what Americans do.
And let me start with you. The president's critics say the help he is giving provides just enough to keep the goal, to keep the war kind of where it is and not to win it. Do you sense there's enough staying power in the U.S. to support this war if it drags on?
I mean, I do think that the moment when the president has made a series of major speeches, when he's just been to Kyiv, when he's made this announcement of new aid, is a strange moment to start the conversation about is there enough staying power? Because right now, it's clear that there is. And he, as he said in Warsaw, there is a surprising amount of bipartisan support for aiding Ukraine. I was just in Munich at the security conference, and there is a very large contingent of Republicans there. I heard several of them speak in public very emotively about our support for Ukraine. So this isn't the issue that's, you know, on the table yet. I mean, of course, it might be down the line if there's a different president or a different Congress, but it's not the issue for the next couple of years. The arguments about whether the aid is enough are complicated. F-16s right now aren't the thing that would make the difference. What makes the difference now is ammunition and getting enough of that and getting it from the right places. The other thing that matters a great deal is technology, and we are supplying Ukrainians with the most contemporary technology. This is mostly software to help them fight the war, and we're training them how to use it. So right now we're at an important moment where the Ukrainians are planning an offensive. It seems that they have what they need to do that, and you know, we just have to make sure they have the ability to use it.
And at the same time, you've said that the president is setting the bar too high when he talks about this war in absolutes, about defending sovereignty and freedom. What do you mean by that?
I didn't say that he was setting the bar too high. I was observing that he's setting it very high. You know, he has essentially promised to protect Ukrainian democracy, to fight for Ukrainian sovereignty, but he also has implied that he will fight for democracy and speak about democracy and advocate for democracy around the world. Right now, it's not United States foreign policy to do that everywhere. You know, thinking about how he will, first of all, maintain the support for Ukraine, over the next, you know, several years, and also how he will, how he will broaden and deepen those arguments, remain to be seen.
Ron, in Washington, D.C., House Republicans like Marjorie Taylor Greene are calling for an audit of aid to Ukraine. Here she is on Fox last night.
There's not bipartisan support among the American people for fighting a war in Ukraine that does nothing for Americans except force them to pay for it.
So, Ron, you know, perhaps there are signs of bipartisan support for now, but over time, do you expect, given the politics in Washington, it could ebb?
There is an election next year, and that is an election for president and also for Congress. And there is a cadre, it's a small cadre, in the Congress, particularly in the House. Many of the same people who stretched out that vote for Kevin McCarthy to be speaker for a week back in January, many of those same people, Matt Gaetz, Lauren Boebert, Paul Gosar, Andy Biggs, the usual cast, those people have come out and said we should cut off aid to Ukraine. And they have a resolution to that effect, which will go nowhere in either the House or the Senate. But they are setting their marker. And they are saying, we are here to be America first and to take the attitude that many took before World War II, that there was really nothing that should get us back to Europe, that there was really nothing that Americans gained by defending liberty on its farther ramparts, that we should wait for the threat to come to our own shores before we took it seriously. Mm-hmm. And that was a very popular view before Pearl Harbor. That was probably a more popular view in this country before the invasion of Ukraine. So the question is, how does the pressure of next year's election with Donald Trump, a candidate, and Ron DeSantis, who hasn't really separated himself from Trump on this issue, how is that going to affect the attitude of the average Republican?
Mm-hmm. But some of these Republicans, more ideological, who are saying to cut off support or slow it down, I mean, they have leverage over the House Speaker, do they not?
Because of the House Speaker's incredible vulnerability to efforts to remove him from office, he will have to entertain them. But that does not give them the majority of the Republican side. And so McCarthy obviously has to be responsive to the majority of his own members, let alone the Democrats.
Let's listen to this tape of Russian President Vladimir Putin rallying his supporters in a Moscow stadium this week.
President Российской Федерации Владимир Владимирович Путин!
Sure sounds like he has a lot of support in this war. Has the conflict exposed the limits of U.S. power in isolating Putin or the power of alliances, Anne?
Those are two separate issues. One is the question of whether he has support in Russia, which is not proven by one rally at a stadium where people walked away early and, you know, said many had been paid to attend. Where 9 out of 10 people hang up the phone when opinion pollsters call them because they don't want to participate in any public conversation at all. So we don't really know what his support is in Russia. It's pretty clear that some of his elite support is pretty low. The business community and others are not at all happy with the war. So that's a complicated issue. On the question of the rest of the world, yes, it's true that for a lot of the world, this war seems either irrelevant or it's happening between, you know, two powers. They imagine it's happening between the United States and Russia. They discount the role of Ukraine and the autonomy of Ukraine in this in the battle. You know, they have other interests. They care more about the grain trade. I think quite a lot of that is understandable. However, every time there's a vote at the UN, it's still overwhelmingly in favor of Russia leaving Ukraine. I think the basic issue, you know, that a large country invaded a small country with no provocation is pretty widely understood.
Of course, one of the other very large countries watching this closely and watching for lessons is China. It has put forth a bit of a peace plan today, which the Biden administration has dismissed. Ron, how does the Washington foreign policy establishment see a potential China-Russia axis?
It's clearly a frightening thought to the Washington policy establishment, as it should be to Americans in general. The idea of the other two superpowers, if you are going to include Russia on the basis of its nuclear strength as a superpower, the idea of having two of the three of them arrayed against us is discouraging and disheartening, especially considering how recently there had been hopes, at least within the Biden administration, that they could do business with China, that they could put a floor, as they said, under the relationship so that it didn't descend any further. There were hopes in that regard. And there were certainly fears at the other extreme that China might be trying to do something in Taiwan, much like Russia has been trying to do in Ukraine. And so there was concern in that respect as well. So the idea of there being some sort of alliance, and obviously the Chinese have been much more helpful to the Russians than we had hoped they would be in the past year. But going forward, if they were to provide ammunition, lethal aid, as we call it, that would be seen as much more provocative and moving us towards much more of the kind of superpower confrontation than we've seen in the past.
Why would China do that?
Why would China do that? Because China is interested in isolating the United States out to one side. And I would really love to give Anne time to answer that same question if there's time.
Yeah, Anne, please.
China has an interest in defending autocracies and defending the rights of autocratic leaders around the world. and feels threatened by the liberal democratic language used by Ukrainians and used by the coalition that has come together to support Ukraine, just as Russia does. So China presumably sees Russia as a kind of ideological ally, even though they're so very different. You know, one calls itself a communist country, one is a nationalist state. Nevertheless, they have this common set of enemies, and that is a reason why they seek, why they continue to create a kind of alliance, but not a very trusting alliance with Russia.
That is Anne Applebaum, staff writer at The Atlantic, and we've also been talking to Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. Thanks to you both.
Thanks to you.
Thank you.